Perhaps you're living with chronic pain, like in your back, shoulders, hip, knees, neck. Jeez, I've got shoulder, neck, back, got all of it. Well, I want you to try BioWave Go, non-medication, superior pain relief technology for people that are in serious pain and serious about leading a pain-free life. BioWave Go is a patented, FDA-cleared, 100% drug-free pain relief technology, and it's currently used by most professional teams, so it's good enough for them. Why not for us? BioWave Go works by blocking pain deep at the nerve root for up to 24 hours just for after one 30-minute treatment. It can be life-changing. If you want to be able to walk your dog, play with your kids, lift them up, then do yourself or someone you love a favor and learn more at BioWave Go, B-I-O, like biology, wave, like a wave at the sea or waving your hand, BioWave G-O, BioWave Go, one word, .com. And you can speak to a pain relief concierge there or learn more at BioWaveGo.com. To no-risk 30-day money-back guarantee trial with free shipping, what do you got to lose? See if it works for you. It works for professional athletes, chronic pain sufferers. Imagine how much it can help you get back to a fuller, more pain-free life. I love these non-pharmaceutical interventions, and they really do work. We've abandoned them, and look what happened. We have the opiate epidemic. Well, we've got to return to these non-pharmaceutical interventions. They actually work. See for yourself at BioWaveGo.com.
And welcome to Dr. Who Podcast. Keep the wind in the sails of the Corolla pirate ship. Don't forget to do all that. And check out everything that's over at DrWho.com. I want to get right to my guest. Andre Viscontis. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. She's a special guest. I'm a big fan of Inquiring Minds. And so one day I was just scrolling through one after another of your podcasts, and finally I called Gary, our producer, and I went, you got to book her. I got to talk to her. I just got to talk to her. Little did I know, you spend time in my hometown producing operas, which is a weird twist on all this, because I sort of have a heritage in opera too. Little bit, not like yours, not nearly as skilled. And Jordan Harbinger agreed to stay on, of course, from the Jordan Harbinger Show. Those of you that don't know Jordan, check that out, jordanharbinger.com as well. You can get Andre.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to stumble 100 times over that. Check out Inquiring Minds. Check out Cadence. Check out Andre Viscontis, IndreViscontis.com. And thank you for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Were you early days of Inquiring Minds, or was it a different podcast when you were on with Massimo? Was that you?
No. Well, that's early. So it was Point of Inquiry the original.
You and Massimo
podcast.
Were together looking at questionable thinking.
Yeah, it was actually me and Chris Mooney. So okay. I was post Massimo, and yeah, we were essentially looking at people who have strange beliefs, and you know, we were a bit skeptical, and so that was a big part of the show, and then the kind of organizing committee of the show, the Center for Inquiry, did some things that we disagreed with in the way that they treated women in particular, and we just felt that we couldn't have a home there and have as big an audience as we thought that our show deserved. So Chris Mooney at the time was a writer for Mother Jones magazine based in Northern California, and they were looking to do a new podcast. So we retooled it and called it Inquiring Minds. And
it's great.
Yeah,
and you've interviewed all of my very favorite people.
Awesome.
I mean, really people that I'm like fascinated by, some of whom I pulled off of your podcast and brought over here. Did you grow up in this country?
No, I grew up in Canada.
In Canada.
But my parents are Lithuanian, so I didn't speak English until I was 7.
Wow.
But yeah. So I'm
and what brought you down here?
Well, I started doing my PhD at UCLA in neuroscience.
Yeah. And then music was a natural marriage.
Yeah. So my mom's a conductor. And so from the time I was a little kid, she made me go into choirs and learn piano. And I first resisted and then eventually fell in love with opera. Mm. And it was like, you know, if you're a choral singer, opera is kind of like the ugly duckling. It's like the evil stepchild.
Really?
Because you don't have to sound quite as pretty and controlled as you would like in a choir. And you get to go on stage and run around and, you know, they pay you for that. So
right.
It's pretty exciting.
You weren't part of a group.
Yeah.
But I came to opera through, I was sort of musical singing. It got boring very quickly.
Huh.
And what's next? Oh, well, there's that. So I just started doing that.
It's funny to me that opera is like the badass music
singing funny?
Thing. Because it's not really what I think of when I think of opera. It's like, oh, this is where like the cool kids hang out with a leather jacket smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, well, that just shows you how nerdy I am.
Yeah. I love that, though. I'm down with that.
It's hard. Make no mistake about it. It's difficult work.
It looks really hard.
You have to
really
dedicate yourself to it to do it properly. I was always not even a dilettante. I was like whatever's under a dilettante. That's what I was and remain. But let's – I just want to talk a little bit about – so here's some of your stuff. Let me tell the audience about your PhD in cognitive neuroscience. You got a degree in opera from San Francisco Conservatory. So you were in a conservatory?
Yes. I did my master's there. Yeah.
So do you know what happens in conservatories, right? You get your ass handed to you.
It seems
24/7.
Trade school for really talented, hardworking people.
Trade school, it's too light a thought. My son was in a conservatory for a few years and it was like, oh, this is like hardcore.
Yeah.
You're living and breathing. Like when people say they went to Juilliard Acting Conservatory, they lived and breathed it for like 3 years. All they do. And music is obviously super intense because if you're around musical trainers, their expectations are like ridiculous.
Yeah. And you know, it's also you're there with all the other kids who were the top kids in your high school or what have you. And now you're competing against them.
And your other degree is psychology and French literature.
Yeah, it's mandatory.
Naturally. Yeah, of course.
Exactly. What particular French literature?
20th century French drama.
Oh.
So theater of the absurd.
So it's so
does that make more sense?
Kids Camus no. And
it does
yeah
not.
Beckett. You know, yeah, exactly.
Is Beckett French?
Yeah.
I didn't even think about that. He wrote in French?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I didn't even know. I feel foolish.
I mean, I don't even know who that is, so don't feel too foolish.
But Waiting for Godot.
Yeah. Okay, I've heard of that at least.
You would think the name Godot would have clued me in a little bit. But okay. So let's get to the neuroscience stuff because that's really where I nerd out quite a bit. And I want to come to it through Jordan because we got into a conversation on a show I was doing with Adam and Jordan about cognitive distortions and cognitive fallacies. And you started talking about how we live in a world right now where you literally keep cards on you.
Yeah, I bought a deck of cards. Do you know about these? So it's yourlogicalfallacy.is. And it's like you get this deck of cards and there's posters too. And so when you hear something and someone's like making an argument that's a straw man or Texas sharpshooter fallacy, you can go through this deck of, I don't know, 52-ish some odd cards, and you go, I know this is a fallacy. I just can't figure out which one. You sort of read through it, and you go, ah, right, begging the question or like shooting the barn or whatever it is. Huh. And I've been using these. Oh, and when you find it, the bottom has a URL, so you can go, oh, you know what? The problem is, Andre, you used the two quoque fallacy. So go to yourfallacy.is and then /2-quoke or whatever, and it'll like explain to you why.
Oh, I'm sure whoever you're arguing with will run to their
computer.
They
can't wait to find out why they're wrong according to the internet, which is where they got the wrong information in the freaking first place. But it makes me feel better because I go, all right, here are the holes in my own arguments, which I always want. But then here are the holes in this other person's argument, and it's not just, well, that's dumb because it doesn't even make sense. It's like, oh, here's a logical fallacy that you're falling into, and it makes you smarter because you go, you think to yourself, this is a thing that makes sense to a lot of people, but here's why it's actually wrong. You're just mischaracterizing my argument intentionally or not, and then you're poking holes in that. Straw man. It makes you a better thinker.
So do you do that on Twitter too? Like just
that's just a waste of time. Okay, so I'd be lying if I said I don't do it. I do it, but then I go, I'm not going to reply because that person's – and I've tried. They just go, oh, you think because you're smart, you're right? And I'm like, well,
no,
yes.
No, because I'm right.
I'm right because I'm right and because I have this playing card that says that I am.
But what do we do in this world where facts, logic seem not to exist? I feel like there's been a disconnect on two fronts. One is facts don't matter. So anything evidence-based seems to be not even familiar to people's thinking. And the other, everything that is argued from conclusion. Everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're living in a time when social media makes the confirmation bias really easy to fall into all the time. So you're going to seek out information that confirms your hypothesis or your beliefs as opposed
to motivated reasoning. Motivated reasoning on top of that.
So I mean, we all live in our you know increasingly smaller bubbles because of social media, essentially. But I also think that there is this other side to it, which is that we have so much information coming at us all the time that we get exhausted and we get decision fatigue, and so we don't think very deeply about things. Like, when is the last time you sat down and read a book for like 3 hours? And you know, the kind of thinking that engenders is much more analytical, much more open, and I think that's something that we're doing less and less of.
That's a good point. I mean, the last time I did that was probably like on Sunday, but
yeah, I do it all the time. Yeah, yeah. I was going to say I don't want to sound too nerdy, but
yeah. But also, I realized I spent years not doing that because law school made me never want to do that again.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, that didn't work with you and all your studies. You just got more interested in things. It just ruined me for studying things for like a decade, and then I went, oh, not everything is horrifyingly boring. So I do study and read a lot now, but I think it's true. People go, I don't have time to do this, which is sort of true, but it's also it's like, well, you had a lot of time to argue about this on Instagram.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, I also think that when people are looking, you know, at facts and they're trying to figure out what it is that's true, there is an intellectual elitism that they shy away from, right? So they don't want to know that some authority figure is right. You know, that's the other, you know, big homogenizing factor of the internet is that everybody can have an opinion and everybody can point to the Google page or, you know, the Wikipedia page where that opinion is, you know, originates. And so they think that that makes them an expert. And I think that that's sometimes problematic.
Right. And they seem to differentiate. They can't differentiate knowledge from sort of – or information from knowledge.
Yeah. I mean, right? you must get this all the time,
all
like
the time.
In terms of the Dr. Google thing.
Oh, my God.
Right?
My friend, my peers put a thing on their wall now that says, do not confuse your Google search with my medical training.
Right.
Those are
right.
two different things.
Well, I think is, you know, if I had to turn the question around to you and say, what makes your medical training better? What makes you more of an expert?
Experiential learning. I'm very good at experiential learning and I thrive in it. I love it. It's how I develop judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And so really what I tell people is you're not coming to see me for what I learned at the end of the second year of medical school, because that's on Google. You can look at that. I've known it for 30 years. We all know it. But then I spent the next 20 years developing the judgment to make the call for you in this given situation, to make the right call based on my experience. And fortunately, I don't know what it is about those kinds of brains, but I've got one. And so I learned very, very well experience, and I can – it's funny. I heard somebody – mine was on your podcast talking about how you have to be careful with that kind of brain too, because if things start changing, your old paradigms, your old maps remain the same.
Mm.
And I started thinking, oh, I may have some, you know, so I'd be careful with that, because medical experience, the treatment paradigms change so fast that your sense of judgment has to change with that.
Well, like the opioid crisis, right? There was a time when opioids were considered the holy grail.
Please don't even start me. I was not one of the ones saying that, by the way. I did not fall for that bullshit. But I'm going to give a lecture on Friday about that history, because I was in the middle of it going, listen, no, it's not right. You don't got it right. You got it wrong. I was told I was old-fashioned. I was told there was something wrong with my judgment. I was told I was interested in people suffering. Oh, you don't know this about me?
No.
There's a video of me on Larry King the night that Heath Ledger died going, you don't understand. This kid was a drug addict, and this is a tsunami that you're going to hear about any day. It's a tsunami going to blow over this country. And here it came.
Yeah. Do you know that there are these two papers that were really influential where they show that the 1%, you know, you're nodding. Is that's like
Portnoy was the one.
There
was
you go. Yeah.
And the other was a letter, the Jick letter.
The letter.
It was about a 10-sentence letter saying, we don't think – essentially saying that addiction doesn't occur in a hospital setting.
That's right.
Oh, that's insanely ridiculous.
And then Portnoy said – and these two then became these figures that were quoted and misquoted thousands of times, where it became this – well, whenever there's a religious intensity around people's ideologies, when there's an ideology at all when it comes to science, bad outcomes.
Yeah.
You have to be objective at all times. And if you let an ideology start to sweep over you, and then if there's a religious fervor, run.
Ugh.
Because I literally found quotes in this lecture I'm giving from a bunch of pain specialists saying, we thought that we were wearing the white hat. There was they used the word religious fervor. And I was like, I saw it. Literally, I remember I had in my – a lot of the psychiatric peers too, the ones that weren't even caught up and were just psychiatrists at the time – in the DSM-4 at the time, at the bottom of every diagnostic window, they say these diagnostic criteria apply provided that there isn't a medical problem that could be responsible for these symptoms or drug use or drug withdrawal.
Mm.
Do not contemplate this diagnosis if any of those three things are possible. And I said to them – I go one day to a bunch of psychiatrists. I go, I want that up in the admissions office like in a big scroll at the top, because they're making all these diagnoses on people strung out or in withdrawal. You can't. And they literally – the whole room went like – I felt like they were saying, the unenlightened. He just hasn't seen the light yet. One day he will.
Frustrating.
And I thought, wow. It's – religion has no purpose here. It has no utility.
But I mean, you know, if the medical field, which is supposedly built on objective, you know, evidence-based practice, can be so hoodwinked by confirmation bias, you know, as these two papers show.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
What breaks my heart.
What's the hope for the rest of us?
Yeah, what's the hope for the rest of us? Exactly.
We good objective neuroscientists that study music. So you also interviewed Robert Greene. Whoops, I'm actually bringing your podcast on. Robert Greene. And I got to talk to him, too. What did you think of him?
Yeah, I loved him. He was really great. He really nice guy. He's just a prolific reader and writer. Mm-hmm. And so the depth with which he can think is just amazing. And he's super nice, too, which I thought was really great.
Robert Greene?
Oh, yeah.
Power. Perfect.
Good. Yeah, we're all in the same.
You should interview him, too.
I told you about his new book.
Oh, you're the one that got me into him. Okay, you're the one that got me into him. I couldn't remember how he got to me. I knew somebody got me. He was such a pleasure.
He's awesome. Yeah. He's a super nice person and an amazing brain. Yeah. And even as he's recovering now from his stroke, it's like you can just...
What a random event that was.
Oh, my God. The bee sting? Yeah. That's terrifying.
He got a bee sting that essentially inflamed his artery and caused a stroke. So, yeah. Crazy. Yeah. Do you remember his theories of human nature? Do you adhere to them?
I mean, I try. You know?
Well, I thought his point about malignant envy was a very powerful one.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to him about this too. Like, he has a pretty negative view of humanity, but I feel like if you can use his as a kind of do not go list, like all the things that you need to kind of avoid to have a happy life. I feel like he does a great job at that.
But go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, in a way, it's negative, but also he's not like a cynical negative person.
Right, right.
But he's just kind of like, look, here's the reality as I see it, and it's not pretty, but it is very human, and it's navigable, and you can have like productive, healthy relationships. You can have friends and get married and have kids, and it's all going to be fine. But here's all this horrible stuff that goes wrong when it's unchecked.
So I think it was all colored by narcissism, which we are so pervasively influenced by today.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And so a lot of his observations were sort of colored by that. And so he pulled out malignant envy as this destructive. And that's the liability of narcissism. Mm-hmm. That's it. How about Steven Pinker? I'm interested in just talking to you about people you've spoken to. Because you've spoken to all my favorite people.
Yeah.
So we had Steven Pinker on recently. Kishore, my co-host, interviewed him. And I interviewed him a couple years ago at the AAAS meeting. And, you know, he's really interesting in terms of how he thinks about the evolution of the brain and how language is such a central part of what shapes our thinking. And
I think he was educated in that era.
Yeah, that was linguistic roots. But then, you know, he started talking about how the world is not as bad as we think it is, right? In his more recent books. And I think that there's so much room for that. And I think that the arguments that he makes to me are pretty compelling. You know, people have poked holes, especially in his last book, but, you know, sort of just saying that it doesn't quite have the depth of the, you know, the argument isn't quite as strong. But, you know, I still think that there is room for trying to understand violence and negativity in the grand scheme of human history and how we are living in an unprecedentedly peaceful time.
If I remember it, some of the holes being poked in that argument was the flares of violence in the 20th century sort of outweighed his sense that violence was going down, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. I also just think that, there's sort of this economic argument too, where, like, you know, we might not be killing people, but we are certainly harming people all over the world, and we don't care. So even if we're not actively going out and committing genocide, we are not caring about the billions of people that, for example, are going to be affected by climate change.
Right. You're talking about his book, Better Angels of Our Nature.
I'm going
to butcher the title there.
And his more recent one.
I can't remember the title.
I just remember the one. And Neil deGrasse Tyson?
Oh, yeah.
I talked to him a couple weeks ago, and he was very positive about climate change. He said, look, we have dealt with much more serious problems. No problem. We will figure out how to pull the carbon out of the atmosphere. We'll figure it out.
Yeah. And then, this report comes out saying that, you know, we have unprecedented extinction of species in the next, you know, 50 years. And, you know, I hope he's right. I don't know. I mean, I think
we got to get on it. What's it called?
It's called Enlightenment Now.
Enlightenment Now. That's right. About the age of reason.
Yes.
Yeah. And so here he makes the claim again that we are going more towards the age of reason again, and that we are more enlightened. Sort of counter to your argument that you think that facts, you know, people are just ignoring facts
all the time.
I just
feel like, well, for the moment, maybe it's a blip, but But I feel like persuasion is the only thing we can do to talk to people. We can't use logic or arguments.
Yeah. I mean, when people do scientific studies of it, like if I produced a kind of anecdote or versus data, and I asked a bunch of undergraduates which ones they found more compelling, they would say, well, we find the data more compelling. Like, you know, they'll actually say objectively, I think, you know.
Do they mean it, though?
But
they may have changed their worldview.
The problem is that they don't remember the details of the data, right?
Okay.
So whereas a story is much easier to remember.
So true.
Right? And so when you go out into the world and you're making another argument, it's much easier to tell the story and, you know, then remember all the details of the data.
What do you figure from an evolutionary perspective, has us so attached to story?
Well, I think it's a way, you know, so I think memory is not about the past, but about the future, right? And I think that because our memories are not very good, you know.
Well, I believe that like the ritual, all our various kinds of repetitive are just an offloaded memory. I mean, think about Passover. There's no way that story would have lasted 3,000 years. But when people did the same behavior every year, the memory got offloaded to the ritual.
Yeah.
And now you know exactly what happened during Passover.
Yeah.
What they ate, what they said, what they said. They just did this every year ritual.
Although it's probably been changed.
Somewhat, right? But not as nearly as much as if we tried to either remember it or tell the story to our kids. Yeah. It would just be, who knows what it would be, dragons and monsters and stuff.
Yeah, right? No, that's true. But I think, you know, I think we use story in order to enable us to imagine a potential future, right? So, you know, the reason that we remember details of things that happened to us is because that allows us to recapitulate and put together, reconstruct potential consequences of something that might happen in the future. And that's why when you look at patients who have damage to the parts of their brain that prevent them from forming new long-term, these kind of episodic memories, they also can't imagine the future. And if you look in healthy individuals and you watch their brains active when they're remembering the past or when they're imagining a vivid future scenario, same overlap, right? Hmm. That doesn't mean the same processes are going on, but I think that there's a lot of compelling evidence now to show that memory is constructed. Every time we remember something, we actually we change the memory trace itself, right? Mm-hmm. And that wouldn't be evolutionarily a good idea if what we were really interested in is exactly what happened in the past. But it would be a great idea if we need to change certain aspects of what happened in the past to predict the future.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you know this about, like, this is why eyewitnesses are so unreliable?
I do know that eyewitnesses are unreliable from studying criminal law and things like that. They were like, there's brain science in there. And I was like, that's interesting. And all the lawyers were like, whatever. So, yeah, I do remember that. I know. I mean, there's like a footnote at the bottom of the torts book or the crim law book that's like, oh, yeah, neuroscience says this. There's studies. Here's some footnotes that you'll never look at, some citations.
What was your PhD in? What'd you study?
I studied memory. I studied how I worked with patients with epilepsy who had electrodes implanted into the medial temporal lobe, which is the part of the brain that lays down these new long-term memories. And we showed them, new things that they had to learn, and we watched how their cells changed their firing patterns as they learned. And then I also did some neuroimaging work. But yeah, essentially, I was really interested in how these deep structures in the brain are able to kind of create a kind of index or memory trace that eventually then we can continue to retrieve over time in different contexts.
And there's a wide scatter on what people do with memory, right? Or how they lay down memory, what they're remembering and stuff. Because I've noticed that, for instance, one of my sons have screen memories that are remarkably accurate. And when we were younger, they were ridiculously accurate. And
you mean like you see like
see, we can see what happened. We can see it like it's a screen. And both he and I, we sort of would compare notes on things and be exact same screen memory, no deviation or anything. It was pretty accurate. But I'd watch my wife and my other son reconstruct the memories, and oh my God, the two of us just look at it like, that's not what happened.
Oh, that's so interesting. Is that like eidetic memory where it's like photographic?
It's kind of, I had a bit of that when I was a kid. It was experiential stuff. It was always experiential things. And I just noticed one of my sons had it, so I started playing with it a little bit. And I now as I've gotten older, I think there's a little more reconstruction to my memories.
And of course, our friends over at GarmaGuard just sent me the newest all-organic on-the-grow antimicrobial spray, and it's amazing. GarmaGuard, a veteran-owned company, has created a great-smelling antimicrobial for on-the-grow spray designed to kill odor-causing bacteria for your clothes. First product of its kind. You can quickly spray your clothes, uniform, even your shoes while you're wearing them. GarmaGuard is the first all-organic, non-GMO, natural garment antimicrobial spray, which is trusted and used by individuals at home, as well as professionals, physicians, commuters, moms, nurses. Wash your hands all day, right? But what about your clothes? One quick spray with GarmaGuard will help kill microbes on clothing, shoes, uniforms. So wherever you or your family worry about bringing home whatever you come across during the day, use GarmaGuard. Antimicrobial spray, this is in, it can put your mind at ease, killing microorganisms you can't see and keeping your clothes clean and fresh. GarmaGuard will eliminate odors, refresh your clothes between washes, during your workday, after the gym. Children, check it out. Go to GarmaGuard.com. That is GarmaGuard, Garma like garment, GarmaGuard, one word. Use coupon code Drew15 for 15% off your entire purchase. It's amazing. Buy now. Also receive fast, free shipping on all purchases. Love it or your money back at GarmaGuard.com. Don't forget that promo code Drew15, D-R-E-W-15. Let's talk about CBD. It's pretty much everywhere today, and it's a topic I get asked about a lot. Bottom line, CBD, although there are way more claims and anecdotes than clinical science right now, but many people are using it, reporting results, and this is very encouraging. I want to first define exactly what I'm talking about here. CBD, or cannabidiol, is an extract from hemp, and while you might associate it with marijuana, CBD is the non-high-inducing, non-rewarding component. It's responsible for some of the relaxing effects that people describe. Now, there are a ton on the market today, CBDs. Forget the array of benefits that they suggest. It's important to be aware of what you're buying. I recently was introduced to a company called Select CBD, an Oregon-based company that focuses on high-quality ingredients and manufacturing standards, not hype. Their CBD-based products are available in a wide range of formulations and different flavors, of course, each of which is clearly described so you can make an informed decision without all the promises that seem too good to be true and usually are. Like I said, the reported benefits of CBD are very interesting and compelling. I'm excited to see how things develop as the science catches up with this booming industry. If you're ready to try CBD, I encourage you to check out Select CBD. To learn more, go to drdrew.com/select. That is my site, drdrew.com/SELECT. For a limited time, you can save 25% at checkout. I don't know how we do this, but 25% off with the code DrDrew, D-R-D-R-E-W. Well, our friends at TrueCar, of course, remind us that it's just a minute to go get a true cash offer on your car. That's right. The amount of time you're going to be listening to me talk about TrueCar, you could have done it. You could have already gotten a true cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or home. Just go to TrueCar, enter the license plate number of your vehicle, watch the car's details pop up, answer some questions, and then you'll get an accurate true cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It is that easy. After that, you bring your car in, they'll check it out with you. You know, just check it out, no surprises. Then simply leave with your check. It is that easy. That's how easy the true cash offer is from a true car certified dealer. Or if you want to ride out with a new ride, you can lock in a price using the scatter on True Car and, you know, educate yourself about what prices are appropriate. Lock in a price for an actual vehicle on that true car certified dealer's lot. You know it's a fair price because they compete for your business. And you know it's the actual price, it's the true price, because it includes fees and accessories. Then you just simply leave with the new ride. It is that simple. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, remember, you can trade in for a new or used vehicle, a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out True Car today. If you like my show, you're going to love Enough About Me with Shep Rose on Podcast One. Join the Southern Charm star as he talks about reality TV and beyond with his wide array of interesting friends. Download new episodes of Enough About Me every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
I think people remember in different ways when it comes to events. I mean, there's a group of people that are very rare called Highly Superior Autobiographical Memory.
Did you talk to, what's her name, from Taxi?
Oh, no. Does she have it?
What's her name? Help me, Gary. She has it insane. Like, she can tell you what she wore and what she ate on every day of her life.
Yeah.
And
I had real.
And what's her name?
Mary Lou Renner.
Mary Lou Renner. And Mary Lou Henner.
Henner. Yeah. Yeah.
And she, I had I was very depressed when I was in college, and she was on Johnny Carson, and David Letterman was interviewing her because he was feeling for dead. And I just had this sort of moment where I was like, I don't know, I was longing to be back in Los Angeles, and it was a screen memory I had. Mm. And so when I met her 30 years later, I said, you know, Mary Lou, I have this weird moment in my life where you figured strongly. And she goes, oh, yeah, I was wearing the white dress, right? I go, yes, I remember a white dress. And she goes, and she could tell me the shoes. She could tell me what she talked about with David, what she did that day. And she could tell me what the date was, which yeah. I could not do. Mm-hmm. Isn't that wild?
It's so interesting. Yeah. So when you actually look, so you think, well, how do we know these people are actually remembering things accurately? Yeah. I mean, there's some things you can verify, right? Sure. Like what day of the week it was, right?
Yeah.
Life events that happened or big events that happened, you know, that were covered in the news. And it turns out that in these cases, they actually see like almost 100% correct in terms of day of the week.
How is there enough space?
Well, also, yeah.
what is it doing?
Do they have to sacrifice something else to get there? Like
they do.
Or is it just, good. I'm glad to hear that.
I don't know about Mary Lou, but let me tell you about, you know, these patients in general also seem to overlap with people with obsessive compulsive disorder.
Oh, that's interesting.
But their compulsions
I've got a big dose of that,
are to remember. So they spend a lot of time categorizing and cataloging their memories and thinking about, you know, what happened to them. If you look at if you think about what happened to you over the last week.
No, I used to do that. Yeah. I definitely used to do that in childhood. Huh. I did that for sure.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Like what happened over the last week? I would
catalog them and obsess a little bit on them.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And some of them were sort of quasi traumatic, and I'd abuse myself with it a little bit. Even.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, so they don't remember anything more than you or I would over the last week, but they remember much more from a year ago. Right. So what they don't show is forgetting, whereas most of us forget the majority of details of things that happen to us, you know, in a couple days. But people with HSAM, they don't forget. So now imagine you have to develop relationships with people and you don't forget. Right. Like every time somebody said something stupid to you, every time.
I will tell you, it is now that I'm again with an aging brain, I forget a lot more. It's easier emotionally. Yeah. Things don't stay with you as the way they used to.
You can forgive people.
Yeah, you can forget stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So what they
In fact,
lose...
I make a habit of it now.
You have to. Because I know I see my brain idealizing things or being like, and then they did this really nice thing. And my wife will go, well, he had to because this other thing happened. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I see my brain filling in that gap. But I want to remember this person in a pleasant way. So my brain is like, look, man, you're going to forget about the fact that the reason he did this is because you paid him to. You're just going to think, what a nice guy, and it's going to smooth over your relationship, and it's not going to affect you in the future. And my wife's like, nope, made a mental note.
Yeah, so that's what we see. They have trouble maintaining social relationships.
I bet.
You know, I was thinking about your podcast. You know, Damasio is making the rounds right now. Is he somebody you would be interested
sure,
in?
Sure, yeah.
He's got a new book out,
I think. Does he?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
What is it about?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I forget everything now. But I heard him on something else. And,
oh, yeah, we should get him on.
You know what? It's about emotions.
His big thing.
And lately. And that's kind of my big thing, too. I just feel like we've not figured out even vaguely how the autonomic nervous system is processing information in our body and from the environment.
Yeah.
And what is then feeding into the limbic or the thalamus or wherever it's going. We have no idea. And we've got these gigantic brains in our body.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're doing something. And why did the sympathetic system set up with those ganglia along the spine? Why?
Yeah.
Why is it processing that way?
Yeah. I mean, for me, when I teach this to my, you know, undergraduate students, super simplified idea is that I say they're chains of linked ganglia because when you're in fight or flight, that has to happen like this, right? You can't.
So it's an amplification.
It has to be coordinated.
So it's an amplification process.
Well, yeah, but also it's a coordination of body actions, right? So heart racing, get rid of anything in your digestive tract that's going to keep
you
from...
But why didn't it just use a vagus nerve? Why didn't it go direct? Why these ganglion along the spine?
Oh, good question.
Why did it set up that way? It's weird.
I don't know.
And then sometimes the parasympathetic, sympathetic nerves are coexisting in certain pathways.
Yeah. But the parasympathetic nervous system is not linked, right? So they can act more independently, right? So, and that's because when you're resting or digesting, it doesn't, you know, you don't have to have this coordinated behavior.
Do you read Stephen Porges' stuff about this?
No.
Vagal theory? Oh, you'd love this.
Okay.
Yeah. I it's hard to describe in just a minute here, but essentially he has an evolutionary theory about the parasympathetic system being a lower system essentially that we call upon when we are – it has two functions. One is shut down. Mm-hmm. When strike is going to occur, and it also has a social interactive sort of component to it, where it's hooked into the development of the branchial pouches. So even our ear attunement to vocal prosody, our voices, our eyes, and some of what we do with our face is all picked up with the vagus. It's all linked into the nuclei for the vagus nerve.
It's super interesting.
Which is three different nuclei.
I mean, I agree with you. Like, the autonomic nervous system we know so little about. And, you know,
this is where feelings come from, where emotions come from, and that's directing our reasoning.
Yeah. Well, do you remember in the 90s there was that book that came out called The Heart's Code, you know, talking about essentially neurons in the heart that retain memories, you know, that retain a trace. So if you get a heart transplant, you actually, you know, have some of the kind of quote unquote memories
of that person. Yeah.
Like, oh, and then like nobody talked about it anymore.
Insane.
Yeah. There's something to that.
There's something to it. Like,
when people say my heart hurts, I think they're describing something that's actually happening.
Well, and people who have heart attacks after they have emotional events, like, that's clearly related to.
And when they have heart attacks, they have emotional difficulties after that too.
Yeah. 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 The post cardiac depression.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's. Somebody having memories of a heart.
You're freaking out.
That is amazing. Yeah. And yeah, that does freak me out a little, because I'm thinking, get a heart transplant. And then you're like, I assume you're not just replaying images in your head like you would from a regular memory, but you're feeling things or something.
Let me pull the curtain all the way back here and talk about experiences I've had both as a patient in therapy and in doing therapeutic kind of relating to other people. I will hear music and smells and hear pain and feel things that are not me. Literally not me. Typically with people that had trauma, as though those walled off pieces get projected out in some way, or sort of communicating in some way with us, the outside world. But literally, I mean, I have had uncanny, bizarre experiences.
Wow.
Where when I just get over – like, all right, my paradigm experience was a guy I was seeing, and he was it's horrible abuse, terrible, terrible abuse when I was a kid. And he'd come in every day and talk about it. And when he'd come in, I'd hear the opening music of Mad Men. Na, 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 na. I thought to myself, well, I don't hear that every day. So that's something we're co-creating at least. And and then as days went on, I not only would hear the music, every time he sat down, I started feeling like I was that shadowy figure falling through the building. Mm-hmm. I had that sensation. Huh. And after about 2 weeks of without exception, that feeling happening, the music playing. He comes in one day, the music starts, I'm falling, there it is. I'm you know, staying focused on him. And all of a sudden, I feel like I'm an infant falling through these buildings. And it was this overwhelming feeling. It took my breath away. And I stopped him. I said, I'm having an experience. I don't know if perhaps this is meaning for you, to you. And he goes, fuck you. Are you psychobabble? You think you know everything? He stormed out of the room. Came back the next day and he went, how did you know? There's a baby screaming in my head all the time. The baby, the baby, the baby. It's falling. It's dying. It's screaming.
How weird.
That is crazy.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? That's some sort of bodily based communication or something. You know, it's like something.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the skeptic in me, though, is like, is this just it's like cold reading where like you put something out there and he like latched onto it and was like, yeah, that's true. Like, had you been more like, was it vague enough, or what, do you feel that? You know, and maybe this is like how cold reading works, is that a good cold reader can see things in your body language that are meaningful to them. You know what I mean?
In other words, he would evoke this.
That there's something about what he was doing that you read into it, like that there is, you know, that maybe some kind of postural thing, maybe there is something about, like, I don't know, some gesture that he did.
So I was feeling this falling feeling and the music and everything because of something he was doing.
Yeah.
I have no problem with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's for sure what was happening, right? Yeah. I mean, I was having a reaction to something that he was giving me that was not me.
Right.
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 But it was weird that it had meaning to him. That's what I found was weird about it.
Yeah.
And whether that was real or not. Right. This is not some sort of carefully conducted study. But I've had millions of other experiences like that. And always when I bring it up, there's a very similar reaction in the patient. They always go, yeah, that's where my dad always kicked me in the back. Yeah, he kicked me. And they would just go on as though – because we were in it together.
Right.
As though, of course, you know, that's where my dad used to beat the shit out of me. And anyway, what I was saying. And very weird kinds of things like that.
I mean, I would love to go over – well, I don't know if I would actually love to, but I would be curious if somebody else would go over like the 1,000 hours of videotape you have with these people.
Yeah.
And maybe he's like recounting these experiences and rubbing like a certain part of his back and you're going, because you're getting prompted for this.
It could be. But I would tell you that usually it's me sitting quietly and them sitting quietly.
Sure.
Not much going on. And – the point is just that we communicate in ways other than – in all kinds of ways that this instrument is not perfect.
Right.
Right? This is not a – and there's – I'm suspicious that there's something about the autonomic system that communicates or picks up on things or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think that's absolutely true. You know, even, you know, the serotonin receptors in your gut, you know, people talk about now and the microbiome and, mm-hmm. and all this kind of stuff. And I think that, you know, there is a danger of like trying to go too far down that road before we understand it.
Yes.
But I think it's an area that's ripe for more research.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of those quacky areas now where someone starts a company and they're like, hey, take this bacteria if you want to be more attractive pheromone-wise.
And they always start with, have you ever had a gut feeling? Well, guess what? That's the brain in your guts. It's
right.
like,
eh. Yeah.
All right. But
so, yeah.
All right. Jonathan Haidt. How about him?
Yeah.
Jonathan. Yeah. You talk to, I love that guy. What did you learn from him?
Man, you're putting me on the spot to remember all my previous guests.
You don't have to. If anything stands out.
The Coddling of the American Mind.
Yes, The Coddling. That's his latest book.
Okay, I haven't read that one. I think we were talking about, it was related to the election. We were talking about conservatives and liberals and, you know, there's a part of me that's just blocked out a lot of those interviews because we were so woefully incorrect.
You had another thing about intuition in our political views too, or something like that. What was that one? Intuition and reason divide our politics.
Yeah. Because people who identify as Democrat tend to be more comfortable with uncertainty than people who identify as conservatives.
Interesting.
Yeah, and people who identify as conservatives tend to trust their gut in that sense and sort of rely more, perhaps even it's even possible that they have. You know, the insula is a part of the brain that is involved in an emotion called, well, disgust, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know what disgust is.
I'm familiar.
And it's the only emotion that really has a pretty distinctive, you know, signature in the brain. All the other emotions have like, they're all over the brain, right? We can't. But anyway, disgust is an emotion that is really tied to our own understanding of who we are as a people. And so, you know, you can think about it like, you know, something, if somebody does something that you don't agree with, you can feel disgusted by it, which is weird, right?
I think there's a lot of that these days.
Oh, there's a lot of that these days, you know, exactly. And, you know, so this kind of intuition and that you let that feeling dictate a lot of your choices, then you tend to vote conservative. And that's where, you know, people like Donald Trump really excel in inciting those kinds of feelings and those kinds of thoughts.
I wonder if some of this, all the righteousness, is actually some sort of disguised disgust.
Oh, I mean, look at his face. I mean, there's so many pictures of Trump showing the disgust face all the time, right? And yeah, so, you know, I think that's a big part of his message.
You know, another interesting thing about disgust, when I find people make marked changes in their life, like moments of change, which I deal with all the time, they will always have some kind of moment where they see themselves clearly for a moment, and they'll get disgusted with themselves.
Oh, that's,
and they'll change. It's a powerful motivator. And usually, because I've been with patients many, many times with this, and it often involves even a mirror where they will like literally see themselves. They either see something about somebody else. I had a woman call a radio show today and said, you know, I was talking about this experience. And she said, yeah, I had that experience. I was in a hospital. I was hung up to an IV. I was walking out to smoke. I was 25 years old. And there was another 25-year-old with her IV looking horrible, smoking out there. And I went, I don't want to be that.
Huh.
I can see that. I couldn't see myself doing it, but I could see her. That's disgusting. Never smoked again. And the other thing with addicts and stuff, it's usually – they see themselves through like a new pair of glasses. They start opening themselves to, for whatever reason, somebody gets close to them that's different than the usual person they're hanging with, and they start to either get close to them or listen to them or hear perspectives about themselves from that person, and they just get enough to be able to see themselves as they are, and it shocks them. They'll have a moment of just shock and then disgust, and then they're willing to change.
I mean, you know, it doesn't surprise me that these two things would be linked given how close they are in the brain and how this is the part of the brain that essentially pulls your identity together and your sense of self.
The insula.
Wow. The insula. Yeah.
Now, the insula is also the part that's been implicated in chronic pain.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What do you think
it
that
has
is?
It has a pole, anterior, posterior. And, you know, if you go from one side to the other, you go from like the kind of superficial feelings in your body, like, you know.
So that's the pain part.
Maybe it's even further down, you know, a little bit. But like, you know, just like, you know, somebody touching the outside of your skin, like the very edges. And then the deeper you go into the insula, the more kind of abstract it becomes. So, you know, you have like, and then you have your whole kind of your gut feeling stuff, and then your, you know, sense of who you are, and it's implicated ultimately in theory of mind, your understanding that other people have.
How do you think sense of who you are and somatic?
Well, because you have to feel
who you are.
Yeah, right? You know, you got to be comfortable in your body. That's what we say things like that, right? That's who you are. So your body is a big part of, you know, how your brain builds its own identity.
People, the Cartesian dualism has sort of screwed us up on that. Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. Do people still believe? I guess they do. Yeah.
In the 90s, it was all about, did you train in the 90s or after that?
Early 2000s.
If you remember, it was the decade of the brain, decade of the brain. And that's all they were talking about was the brain.
Like it exists outside the body.
Yeah. Yeah. There was what went on in the skull was all that mattered.
Yep.
And now I think we've understood that it's embedded brain.
Yeah.
Embedded in a more of a central nervous system, in an autonomic system, in a body, in a social context.
Yeah.
All this embeddedness is really what makes the brain such a wonderful instrument.
Yeah, this is why virtual reality is like the coolest thing I think ever, because I can all of a sudden see its potential of us changing the way that our minds work by putting us into a virtual reality.
By the same token, though, it makes me skeptical of artificial intelligence.
Uh-huh.
Because there's no body.
Right.
We're informed by all that. That's where our intelligence really comes from.
I mean, I think that might be a little bit of a, I don't want to say misconception, but like a different conception of what intelligence
what AI
might be.
Is.
Yeah, because I feel like AI is more like, I don't want to overuse the term machine learning, which is statistics, but cool and buzzwordy. But AI is kind of like, it very much learns, but it's not like human generalized intelligence.
It's not holistic the way this is, and it's not embedded the way
it doesn't feel, and it probably, and I'd say probably never will, and never is now a finite amount of time, because like in 200 years it probably will, something like that.
Yeah, do you guys ever watch the movie Ex Machina?
Yes.
Have you seen that? Mm-hmm. Right. Well, Gary's giving me a thumbs up.
We're gonna ruin this movie.
How
for
have you.
You
not seen that?
You are
assigned to that movie.
All right.
Okay. Well, anyway, it's just part of it is like it's a big Turing test, right? So you've got two characters who are trying, or you've got a character who's an AI, and you've got a character who's supposed to evaluate whether that AI has consciousness, okay, by interacting with the AI. But there's this one part where the AI talks about how, you know, she can learn everything there is to know about color. This is the classic philosophical problem.
Mary in the room.
But if she doesn't actually see color, if she lives in a black and white room, does that make her really understand the experience of seeing color, right? Should I give away the spoiler? So the entire movie is about her trying to get out of this compound that she's been encased in, because then she can be conscious, because that's Mary leaving the room and seeing color, right? Because Mary's in a black and white room. So the whole idea is like she's
consciousness automatically happens when you
consciousness things. Comes with experience. Yes. So that's a key. She's never going to be conscious.
I think conscious happens is co-created
interaction. I agree.
I think it's something that if I grew up in the woods and came out of the woods at 13 as a feral child, I don't think I would have consciousness.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's something that's co-created.
I have two kids and I've watched one of them become conscious and the other one's
not. And it's
not
because of his or her relation to you, though, that they develop it.
That's right. They start to see themselves.
So when is somebody going to say this? Please say it. Because no one has said it. Yeah. I have all these people talking about the hard problem, and they keep thinking about one instrument.
It's true. It's interaction.
Co-created. It's somehow you provide a perspective of me that gives me a sense of my experience.
That's right. And I mean, it's really weird. Like when they're super little, like my daughter's super little, like she doesn't understand that like I can't read her mind. Like she just thinks like if she cries, I'm going to know what to do, but I don't know what to do. And then eventually they're you know, two or three, and they figure out, they have to tell you. And it's like this light turns on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you see it in their faces. They're like, holy shit, I need to tell you, but I can do that. And then you'll know.
That's impressive. That's really cool. I also understand. I just realized now I didn't understand most of Ex Machina, because I'm watching it and I'm like, cool, yeah, this is like a Turing test thing, and then he like gets tricked by the robot, and I'm like, oh,
it's an action film.
That whole thing right over my head.
But it is that phenomenon of what it's like to
experience
red,
exactly.
To be a bat, to whatever.
Yeah,
and yes. I'm as I'm sitting here, some thought is forming in my head about the insula and how it may be the source of some of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I'm feeling, because it's a piece that needs to be deeper, more deeply studied.
Yeah, so it gets even weirder. So there are these kinds of cells in the insula and in a couple other areas of the brain that are involved in social interactions called von Economo neurons. Mm. So they're like long neurons that, you know, they're in really big animals, but big animals that are also social, like elephants have them and dolphins have them. But animals that don't seem to be social don't seem to have them. So one of the ideas is that von Economo neurons are involved in some kind of social function. And there are patients who develop something called frontotemporal dementia, mm-hmm. which, you know, essentially they lose in the beginning of the disease, this region and these cells in particular, and they develop all kinds of problems with social interactions.
And self-functioning, too.
And self-functioning. Yeah, they make poor decisions. They're impulsive. And so they become, in some ways, you know, I don't want to say they're less conscious, but certainly they have a much more impaired ability to think about someone else's consciousness.
Phileas Gage.
Exactly.
Very similar to that.
Is that kind of an animal quality? Like, hey, look, I'm just going to do this thing because it occurred to me? Or is that just impulsive in the general
That's
sense?
Prefrontal cortical stuff. This is a little different.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like they don't read. They don't read social things, and they don't really experience themselves in a social context.
That's right. So there's this video of this guy who's talking about why he abused his dog. And he has they have flat affect. Oops, sorry. They have flat affect. So they don't actually show a lot of facial expressions of emotion. And he's talking about well, why did you hit the dog? And he was like, well, the dog was barking. And he just couldn't imagine that the dog could suffer. And they were like, well, but the dog would be sad. No, he's not sad. He stopped barking. You know, he died.
It's a psychopath.
You know, it's like the problem is solved, right?
Oh, that's
crazy.
That's a psychopath thing.
Yeah.
Very much how they think.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
We need to drill in deeper. I'm just wondering if – I wonder if Damasio has any opinion about this.
Oh, I'm sure he does.
Yeah.
I'm sure he does. Yeah. Yeah, he's coming on your show.
No, I would love to have him come on, but I want to hear you talk to him more than want to talk to him.
Yeah, no, I'll definitely talk to him about this. Yeah.
Yeah, this is interesting stuff.
Yeah, and he has this whole somatic hypothesis, too, about the body being a big, you know, prominent figure in terms of how we process emotions, right?
It's where feelings come from, right?
Yeah, yeah. And also, I feel like in the decade of the brain, he was one of the few people saying, hang on a minute. Let's think about the body too.
He was also interested in sort of the wiring much more. And I think when you get into the wiring, you can get really lost pretty quickly. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, for a lot of reasons, right? I mean, wiring changes, but also what networks belong to each other. That's something that neuroimaging is really trying to
tease
apart now. It's really hard to understand. And also we have this default mode network, which means that when we're just kind of doing nothing, there are parts of our brains that are synchronizing with each other and communicating with each other and
doing something.
Yeah, that's why when you're in the shower, you're like, oh, that is such a good idea. Oh. I have a notepad in the shower because
my shower is the best, most creative thinking, best part of the day.
100%
I do my best
agree.
Thinking in the shower. It's something about the recent awakening.
Yeah.
Something about it. There's free thinking that's going on in the shower.
Showers and walks.
The cortex has one layer of cells that no other animal has, right? Isn't that correct?
Is
sort of a pyramidal cell or something?
You mean the six-layer cortex of the human brain?
Yes.
Yeah, I'll take your word for it. I don't know about chimpanzees or other primates.
I remember reading or something about there being this one layer that no one else had, and it was a laterally sort of integrating layer. And I thought, why aren't people thinking about that as the layer in which we learn? It seems to be the area that's creating all these different integrations.
Yeah.
If we have that, and it's... It's an integrative sort of – it's not going deep. It's not going frontal or caudally. It's just integrating layers. It seems like a learning possibility there.
I mean, for sure. But I mean, we see traces of learning in so many different aspects of the brain, you know, from receptors and neurochemistry all the way to rewiring.
Well, right. I mean, you could messenger RNA or the RNA fragments in the synaptic buttons is a kind of a learning paradigm, right?
Yeah. But even if you look at wide swaths of connections between neurons, you know, we see white matter changes when people learn, you know, all the time. So I feel like there's signatures at every level of experience. And that's to me what I think, why I think, again, you need experience to have a conscious AI, because you're constantly essentially changing the way the brain, works to a certain extent. The neuroplasticity has biological limitations, but, I also think that's what makes the brain is the fact that it does change.
The other thing that I trouble with these days is there seems like biology has not been taught in 20 years or something, because the basic idea of how biology works seems to have escaped everybody.
Yeah.
Even people that are supposed to be trained in biology.
I mean, you know, biology I think the great universities really focus on evolution in the first few, you know, the first year of biology.
Yeah.
And then people stop taking it, so they don't they don't get to the good stuff, right?
Couple Punnett squares and I'm out.
Yeah. But it's so important to really deeply understand evolution because it essentially is this unifying theory of virtually every aspect of biology.
Right. It's a unifying theory of biology, but biological systems are potentially chemistry. They're biochemistry, really.
Well, so there's the systems approach that I think that people don't, you know, becomes too complicated too fast and people don't proceed.
Yeah. Well, so much biology is built on these wide sweeping sort of probabilities, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's just like we're like a giant probability equation that's sort of working out. Mm-hmm. And our brains don't judge probabilities very well. So it's a very hard thing for people to think about.
Yeah. We're not really good about thinking about big numbers in particular.
Big numbers.
Right? You know, so there's that classic problem where, you know, if you've got a high PSA count, you know, how likely do you have prostate cancer? And you walk into your doctor's office and you have this high PSA count and, you know, there's a 20% false positive rate. But, you know, so, and what people fail to do is realize that, you know, the number of people coming in with high PSA counts that are false positives far outweighs the small proportion, like the 2% of the population that actually have prostate cancer, right? So they don't consider that prior probability. Am I being clear? Have I lost you?
Okay, it's just that clinically, it's kind of because we have ways of approaching that.
Right. Well, exactly. Yeah. You do. Yeah. But the average person, when given that problem and told to put on a white coat and decide whether this person has cancer, what the likelihood of cancer is, they fail that problem all the time.
They
overestimate.
Yeah. It's an interest, again, back to experiential learning. As a patient, I was the subject of something like this on the other side of the equation where my PSA had gone from 1 to 4 and I was like, recheck it in 6 months. Don't even worry about it. Don't even think about it. And my internist was like, no, I don't want you to see a urologist. Something doesn't feel right to me. I know what. I was perfectly fine with coming back in a year even. I had no problem. So we go and he's like, yeah, you shouldn't be here. It's prostatitis probably. We'll treat you. So you clinically treat with anti-inflammatories, antibiotics. Uh-huh. PSA didn't go down. Well, let's try it again. Didn't go down. Well, now you need a biopsy. And I'm like, God damn it. I hate everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What the hell? Yeah. This is such bad overkill. Biopsy, prostate cancer.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Well, but you went through multiple.
Yeah,
you know,
but it was brilliant judgment on everybody's part.
Right. Right.
Because
they
could have caved to me very easily.
Sure.
Because I was like, I'll come back in a year. Don't worry about it.
Right,
you know,
right,
come
right,
on.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And then when it came time for biopsy, I'm like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous.
Angry.
Talking about overkill.
Yeah.
Prostate cancer.
Oh, I'm a hypochondriac of right now.
So,
every mole I'm going to
get. But it shows you how at each step the judgment was just like, my judgment is this, that doesn't feel right. Even the prostate PSA was normal.
Right.
But it just wasn't behaving right given experience.
But the first, you know, most people will come in and with that high PSA count immediately go to, I have cancer.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
and
that's
the problem.
I went the other way.
It's the WebMD.
You assholes are overreacting.
Dr. Google, like, crap, I'm dying. I have all kinds of diseases that were eradicated in 1650 now.
Yeah. And I think that's because, you know, and partly we're trying to use the part of our brain, you know, that is about rational thinking to, you know, think of this hard, you know, Kahneman has this thinking fast and slow thing. Mm-hmm. So we're essentially trying to use our slow, deliberate brain to work on problems that actually our fast brain is much better at, our intuitive, like we actually can extract probabilities and regularities in the environment intuitively in some ways much better than, you know, we can explicitly.
This is like the Malcolm Gladwell blink.
Yes.
Type
yes.
Stuff.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
I think ideally, I think using both. Is,
I mean, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
You check one against the other.
That's right.
You don't rely on one. You use
yeah.
both.
Well, the problem is that, you know, system one, the fast thinking system, continues to feed information to system two, and system two is lazy, so it just picks the first thing that feels right, which is not always the right answer.
But that's where training comes in, right?
That's right.
And this is the part I'm complaining about. Everyone is lazy today.
Yeah.
They don't use that system at all,
so you
end up trying to persuade people as opposed to argue.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't train up that system to actually go and do the hard work of making sure that double checking
their
work.
And by the way, it becomes pretty easy after you've done it for a while, right? I mean, it's not that hard. You do it in law school all the time.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. That's where I even got brought the idea that you might check something that you feel mm-hmm. one way about. I'm like, oh, I should look this up. Maybe high school and college a little bit because I had some great teachers. But I remember seeing things like, this is probably a poor analogy. You'll get it during election season. There'll be like a casino ad and it's like, help save our schools and vote yes on Prop B. And you're like, really? Who would vote no on this? There's got to be an opposing argument. You Google it and it's like, actually, this taxes the crap out of like mm-hmm. other things. Yeah. And this is paid for by these like Indian casinos that are not taxed. And so it's not really save the schools. It's like, don't tax this particular industry. And then that kind of thing never occurs to most people. And voter elections, people, politicians, companies, marketers, they're all so acutely aware of this.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, yeah, they can put out one press release that looks plausible and everyone's system too will be like, yep, got it. Yeah.
Done, done and done.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, you don't like this? You hate babies. There's no other reason you would do this. You just hate babies.
So I got to move towards wrapping things up. Obviously, we can go another hour easily. Tell me about Cadence.
Oh, so Cadence is a podcast I started that's a little bit more produced. And, you know, for a long time, I didn't want to use neuroscience to dissect music. I didn't want to take the magic out of it. So then I wondered, what if I turned this around and actually used music to try to understand our minds better? And that's where Cadence started, where I started using it as a kind of way of exploring what music tells us about the mind, right? So why are we obsessed with this, like, totally ridiculous thing? And what does that tell us about our humanity? Mm-hmm. So the first season was just a kind of music in the brain overview. The second season was really music as medicine, you know, how music can help us. And now I'm working on the third season, which is how music influences us, even outside of our own awareness.
Interesting. And do you want to promote any performances coming up or?
Well, I'm on a book tour, so I want to promote the book.
What's the book?
So the book is called How Music Can Make You Better, which came out of the second season of Cadence. Chronicle, my publisher up in San Francisco, the editor there heard Cadence and thought, well, this could make a good book. And so, it also has these three parts, except the third part is really music and society. And so, yeah, I'm excited to talk about that. So that's my current, sort of stuff right now.
Give us a little more on it.
Okay, so it's a little book. It's only like 15,000 words, but essentially it's geared towards people who are interested in music and want to understand what it does to their brains. Mm-hmm. And so it has, you know, I spent a lot of time kind of debunking things like the Mozart effect, but also talking about how, you know, 10,000 hours, each hour is not created equal. So, you know, how you actually need to schedule your practice and strategize in order to become more efficient at what you're doing. But I also show how, like, music is for everybody. We have, you know, the kind of modern tragedy of just thinking that, like, people say this to me all the time. Well, you know, I really like such and such a singer, but I don't know if they're a good singer. I'm like, if you like them, they're a good singer.
Yeah.
You know, they've moved you. You know, so, you know, why do you need somebody who's trained in opera to tell you something like objectively about their technique? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, so, and I think that's too bad. And I think with the kind of the fact that we have, you know, ubiquitous recordings everywhere, like, you know, people don't participate in music making as much as they used to.
Right.
And that's really a tragedy.
We also don't study music.
Yeah. I mean, we study it because we listen to it a lot. And, I, you know, to me, I don't think you need to go to formal music school in order to really become very knowledgeable about music. You know, I give the example of I didn't really understand jazz when I was in my 20s. And I went to this, like, bar in Manhattan and, like, there was jazz playing and I was so bored. And I was like, how people like this? And then eventually I learned what to listen for, which is, like, in your head, you know what the melody is. And then you watch or listen to the soloist kind of riffing around it. And, like, you know, and so now all of a sudden I know how to listen to jazz, and it's so much more interesting.
Right.
But it took a little bit of homework.
Yeah. And same as true of classical music, if you understand some symphonic theory.
It's exactly
theory.
The same. That's right. That's right. And it used to be that classical music was piped in everywhere, so people eventually, over time, would get exposed to it, and they'd have this, you know, this statistical regularities they'd kind of learn.
Yeah.
But now that's not the case anymore, so people find it very off-putting. And also, they think that they're, you know, that they're, if they don't enjoy it, they're, like, not smart or something.
Sure.
Which is weird.
Yeah. And you'd have to go to the dentist. You'll always hear classical music. No problem.
Who is your orchestra for the opera?
You mean at Pasadena Opera?
Yeah,
so we always put it together, and we have different orchestra kind of configurations, but we use a lot of local musicians, and they're all really great. Yeah.
It's so crazy to me. Pasadena has had a lot of experimental music over the years, and I always wish they'd just stay with some basics too, because we want to expose all the kids to Mozart's okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Maybe eventually. We did Così fan tutte.
Okay, well, there you go.
Yeah, we said it. We had Jonathan Lynn directing it. He directed My Cousin Vinny, and he set it in 1967.
Oh my God,
San Francisco.
How great!
Yeah,
oh,
it was great. It was great. It was super funny.
It was just it was full production.
Full production. Oh yeah, God. We set it in San Francisco, 1967. So you know the characters like are going off to you know the war, and you know they're all high on mushrooms, which is why the plot makes sense. Anybody who knows the plot, they're like, "There's no way it makes sense." But it's like if they're high, it makes sense.
Perfect.
So anyway.
Well, listen. Thank you for joining me. Really, really, genuinely appreciate it. It's been a privilege, and thanks for helping me out.
Yeah, this is Jordan fun. Hamidou. I feel like we've all read the same books, which is like a miracle. That never happens to me.
And I need to see those cards because I want to carry them around with me.
I will get you a deck of those cards.
Done and done. Anything else before we wrap this thing up?
No, thanks very much for having me.
Pleasure. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the swinging sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.